Well, he had left it to Mr. Todd to confirm whether he was going to be here or not this morning.
Well, that's okay.
We can
take that
approach. No. Mr. Williams has said that he understands that he won't be. He'll be attending tomorrow. And I understand Ms. Fraser has confirmed that she is not appearing.
Right.
So it is just myself and Mr. Williams.
Well, I think the next aspect is we'll do what Mr. Williams says, and then we need to get time to discuss the board.
Yes, I'm completely happy with that approach. I'm not sure if you've had the opportunity to pre-read my submissions, but I didn't. I wasn't intending to add to those submissions today.
That's because we had pre-read Mr. Williams' evidence, so he has a summary of conditions to present, that's fine.
Just a couple of matters of clarification. Well, first of all, there's a typo that's been identified in Mr. Williams' evidence that we would like to correct.
Yes.
Yeah, it's at paragraph 71. And just with the reworded or suggested rewording of the policy, the word not.
I read it about 5 times. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. And then the other matter that we just wanted to seek some clarification on is we've quickly reviewed the memorandum filed by Mr. Winchester with the revised objectives and policies that we received last night. And so Mr. Williams has considered those and does have some comments on those, but we were wondering to what extent the panel was perhaps going to question him on that or would be seeking comment on that or from submitters generally.
Well, if he was to, I don't know if Mr. Williams is prepared or something he was able to read out, but if he has, he could do that. That saves us trying to extract from him his thoughts and enables him to provide them in advance.
I haven't prepared a summary.
That's fine. Him,
but yeah, I have looked at the many provisions this morning. So I can talk through those a little bit if you'd like, but obviously I haven't had a great deal of time to look at them yet.
Probably more than I have.
So if you like, I can just
go through.
So obviously with our submitters, we've only looked at the landscape-related matters. I think the first thing I noted was with goal 3.2.5 and then objective 1 with the addition of inappropriate.
So that's 3.2.5?
Page 3.5.
Okay.
Yes.
And then objective 3.2.5.1, which is the first of the landscape objectives, and the rewording there now provides for the addition of inappropriate. And I support that. And the next objective is the one I see.
Sorry, Mr. Williams, while we're there, can I just please ask another change that has been made is that any reference to natural character or quality is actually being removed. And it's just a statement that's in that piece of planning landscape. Do you think that we need to have either natural character or quality in there with something somewhere later defining what those, that natural character or quality is?
Well, my understanding is that it's the level of natural character of the landscape that will determine whether or not it's outstanding, for example, or else rural landscape in this case. So I see that as forming a subset of your understanding of what an outstanding natural landscape is.
And you think that's a commonly held enough understanding for it not to be, if it's not stated?
So you're saying, suggesting there'd be a definition of what natural character is?
That's a question. Should there be, it's just NAZI's protection of outstanding natural features and landscapes, previous iterations had either natural character or quality. So is the removal of that a concern?
To me, no. I think that better reflects that it's all the qualities that make that landscape wonder, that make it outstanding, it's important to consider. Its natural character and quality are obviously the attributes of that, but I think like when the landscape architects do an analysis of the qualities of the landscape, its natural character and other attributes form part of that assessment. So I see that as probably.
So, but the question I have with that policy, that objective, as it's now written, does it add any value that Section 6B doesn't already provide?
It more closely reflects section. Sorry, what was it? Section 6?
B.
B. So.
I think it limits it rather than more closely reflects.
Yes, it does. It limits that. But I don't necessarily see that as bad. I think it's quite helpful to direct that. Whether or not you choose to go further than that, obviously, is an option. Not bound to simply just read what the Act says, but I think it's particularly important that it recognises that it's inappropriate development that we're trying to manage, because not all development will be inappropriate in the outstanding natural landscape, for example.
I've been reminded by my fellow commissioners that we are going to provide the opportunity for written comments on this by early next week. But we've provided much on that by the end of the week. But it's, as well as these changes, there are some changes arising out of caucusing between Queensland Corporation and Council's planner and at least one other, which we're supposed to receive today, and all of those, they may have some other changes in respect of the events and policies beyond these, and we will make, we'll give everyone who's been heard to comment on those by Monday or Wednesday next week. So while we're here, Mr. Williams' comments now, that won't be very generous.
Thank you.
You might want to listen to some of our questions and respond to that.
Yes, that would be helpful.
I mean, the only other thing I'd say about that is that the current provisions, I have a view that they do seem to work fairly well, in my opinion. And when I refer to those and look at how they're structured, they do probably more closely reflect the Act and use of the terms supporting mitigate, for example. So that in part informs my view as to why I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing that they are picking up that terminology, because it's worked quite effectively in the past, in my opinion.
The modern English
language. Yes, well, and even the...
In an approach.
Yes, that's right. And I think if it wasn't working effectively, or we had a really concern that it just wasn't getting us to where we needed to get to, then that might be a reason to... develop that further, but I don't necessarily think it's the case.
When you say it's worked today, are you reading generally or in the OLs, or specifically in the ONLs and ONS?
Generally.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's
and I think really the only other comments I'd like to make at the moment was with respect to the landscape. So the one I was actually just speaking to before was the objective relating to the rural landscape.
3252.
Yes, yes. Yep. And just the way that it refers to maintained and enhanced. And I feel a little bit uncomfortable with that, noting that again that's drawing reference from Section 7. Where it does say maintenance and enhancement, but I think in all instances to enhance and then what that means within the context of landscape can be quite difficult.
I think that's already been decided by the High Court in about 1992. Was that? Yes, it was quite good. I was about to sell Shell Super Station just around the corner from where I thought.
Yes.
I'm familiar with it. Whatever the court said, maintain and enhance is actually maintain or enhance.
Right.
Okay. All right.
Turning to page 6-2 and objectives relating to landscape. So I reworded objective landscapes are managed and protected from the adverse effects of subdivision use and development, and that sits over all of the landscape policies in that part there. And I just felt that seems to be setting quite a high threshold for all the landscape. Because you then read further down that you have separate objectives relating to ONF, ONL, and rural landscape. And so I just was trying to get my head around how that would sit with an assessment of an application within, for example, the rural landscape classification, and the specific objective there, and then this other objective, which to me seems more restrictive. When you've obviously got the two competing objectives that seem to cover or address, trying to address the same matter. I think when you read the policies, it's more about the mechanics of how it's being achieved, so identifying ONLs, ONFs, etc., directing you to look at the assessment matters,
Mr. Williams. Is there any conflict between the objectives that are in Chapter 6 there compared to the ones that I identified in Chapter 3? That I identified regarding landscape in Chapter 3?
I haven't looked at it that carefully yet, to be fair. So these are just my initial thoughts, but thanks, Kim. Well, again, it comes back to my initial reading of the Directive 6.3.1 seems to be setting the requirement to manage and protect it. And yet the provisions around rural landscapes doesn't set that level. So I see maintenance enhancement as different to protection. And that's sort of going to the point that I sort of initially feel is the difficulty or the tension between that current objective 6.3.1 and then the following objective 6.3.5.
So you think that objective should reflect the bifurcation of the ECA policy, i.e. ONL,
well, I think that in my reading of it, the objectives that lead on after that objective are quite a lot more directed at the issues, cumulative effects, ONLs, ONFs. Lakes and river margins, etc., rural landscape. And yet this other objective is sort of a capture-all, but it's probably more intending to direct how you're going to, some of the methods that are going to be utilised. For example, it's directing that the maps will show where the landscape lines are, and directing you to deal with the assessment matters. So it's almost... Some parts of it are quite mechanical, saying, well, if you go to those assessment areas and you do that, and then you identify the landscape lines, in theory, that's helping to achieve that objective. But my difficulty is just with how the terminology in that sits with those others, given it's an umbrella objective.
Question for you, possibly, as Rob. Is there, in fact, a big difference between protection and maintenance?
Well, in my opinion, there is, but I could be wrong.
Perhaps you can care to tell me what it is, then.
Well, I've always thought maintenance was more towards providing the ability to mitigate something, you could maintain the environment. So it inherently anticipates change, whereas I view protection as being more absolute and static, in that it may not necessarily produce change at all, irrespective of whether that's good or bad.
So, sorry, you're saying that's maintenance or management? Because they're different words, and it sounded like you conflated the two.
Well, management, I understand, is more of a... can be a term for whatever you're maintaining.
And maintenance is saying you can take it.
Yeah, well, I think maintenance means you can maintain the landscape, and that can be achieved through by enabling change, or providing for change within that landscape, for example. But I've always thought that protection was setting that threshold much higher, and that it's protecting it from anything.
So what's the difference?
So protecting but not enabling change.
That's right. Because I think there has to be a distinction, because it's saying protection, maintenance or enhancement. So if they all had the same meaning, I think we'd just use one.
word.
So it's different to promoted, isn't it?
You can manage something to maintain a certain state, I guess, could be one way of
looking at it. You say that you can manage something to end up with a totally different environment.
Yes.
Could you manage it to protect it?
I suppose the question most of us in the parents are is managed a method rather than is managed a method rather than what you might use as an objective, an outcome.
Yeah, that's right. I think you can, if your desire is to be something, it can be done by certain management regime.
There's maintenance through management.
Protection through the Well, I think you could manage something to maintain it, or you could manage something to protect it. I think is the way of looking at it. But I do think there's a difference between protection and maintenance.
Taking something, you say you'd avoid doing them. As you indicated before, your protection wouldn't enable any change, you said. So that's the way would be to avoid doing something. Well, these are always worth checking out.
Yeah, I think that would be on the spectrum. I don't think protection is probably that definitive, but on the spectrum of maintenance versus protection, I think it's more towards the avoid. And then beyond that, I haven't actually got a terrible lot further through that.
That's fine. You got any comment on the word degradation? Degrade? Degradation? Introduction with me?
Seeing how some of these have been rewritten. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get a concise picture about what an objective is or should do.
Well, I think it should provide the direction of how you intend to address the particular issue. And then the policies identify the key matters that will help you in that process.
In terms of the objective,
yes,
is that sort of the outcome, the goal that you're seeking? You've identified, somebody's clearly identified the issues, they're not necessarily presented in this plan, resource management issues. The objectives are to state where you want to get to, and the policies to how you're going to get there.
Yes, I guess that's right.
Is that a standard planning approach?
Yeah, and I guess that's why they can sometimes be seen, objectives can be somewhat seen as a goal, because it's where you want to get to. I mean, that's what goal is commonly where you want to get to, but.
Okay. Just turning to paragraph 15 on your evidence. The last sentence, in some rural areas, non-rural land use and development in the traditional sense is already an integral part of a landscape character. Do you have any examples in mind in regard to that statement?
Well, I think that some of our examples with the tourism operators, they do form part of that landscape, so like the Skyline example. And I think it was more drawing attention to the fact that there's a presumption that our standing natural landscapes are all just farmed environments, and that isn't necessarily the case.
Just looking at the Skyline example. So. In a proportional sense, what effect does that have on the overall landscape?
Well, I mean, typically the landscape architect would do an evaluation of that, but I mean, I think in real terms it's probably very small. The landscape is very broad.
And that's been, because it was considered in Dr. Reid's report, and she did comment on the fact that despite the skyline being there and the wild and pines being there, that it was still indisputable that it is an ONL. She was specifically considering ONL, the line for the ONL, Wakatipu Basin ONL district wide.
Given that landscapes, all landscapes in the district are quite broad,
yes,
especially the ONLs, do any of the tourism operations in those landscapes from a planning point of view comprise something which is large enough to affect the entire landscape?
None that I'm aware of that I've seen or been involved with. And I think that was, to some extent, the point, and that's why I support the change to allow for an appropriate development, was that the landscapes are really broad, and so their ability to absorb change is quite varied, depending on particular circumstances.
So
So scale is a factor that probably should be taken into account in that consideration.
Yes.
The scale of the
that's, well, that's, I think, inherent in the issue we're dealing with here, which is landscape.
Mm.
It always goes back to a decision of a landscape has to be of a certain size. You know, this case is around the Cadrona Valley examples of, you know, it all had to be R&L, but the valley floor was an area that had more ability to absorb change, but in a landscape sense, it's all part of that same landscape. So I think that's why the policy framework needs to be more, needs to recognise that landscapes are very broad, and so in some instances, it will be very appropriate to enable development, even within an R&L, because they are very broad and complex, so they can accommodate all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
Turning to paragraph 27. In terms of the change that you considered there to include the words avoid, remedy and mitigate,
mm-hmm.
In terms of what direction does that provide to a decision maker when looking at that policy?
I think the direction it sets is that you need to make an analysis of whether or not the effects can be avoided, remedied, or mitigated.
So there shouldn't be more. I mean, that's three options. Doesn't really. Does that just put it off till the point of waiting for a consent to be lodged, rather than having any direction in the plan about?
So we're talking about a policy within the rural landscape objective. I'm not quite sure.
So just generally in terms of a lot of the changes seem to have just adding in avoid, remedy or mitigate into the wording of all the policies.
Yes.
And I'm just, what direction does that give to a decision maker other than it's one of those three? Should it all be just on a case-by-case basis?
Well, I think that's where the landscape you're talking about, the ability for it to absorb change is much greater.
Just put it another way, Mr. Williams. If you have an environment court case and you have that policy, avoid, remedy or mitigate, then the applicant's witness says, well, this mitigates the adverse effects.
Yes.
And you have been asked by a submitter opposing it, what strength would you find in that policy to support opposition to it? That question because one of the problems I've found with some district plans around the country over the years.
Well, I guess it comes back to the character of the landscape.
Does it, or does it come back to an argument about how much mitigation is involved?
To in the context of that landscape, I guess, and the values of that.
For perhaps the policy directly to look at the character of the landscape.
Yes, well, that's.
Which was my question on the original about the change of subject, which had taken out the character.
Well, I think that that should flow into those others, and that. Just trying to find where that policy fits in the rest. Sorry, I'm just still trying to. So my understanding is we had an objective with the recommendation that the policy that sat underneath it be deleted entirely.
It just appears that in the latest, although that's actually the black line strike out.
Yes, but possibly there
was evidence
on the original. Yes, yeah. So I think fundamentally I thought it was helpful to have a policy.
That had been deleted in the 42A report.
Yeah.
Yes, I would agree that it would be helpful if more guidance was given in the policy framework for rural landscapes around the qualities.
And also for ONL zonings? Or do you think that adequately defined already? That's a question you look at also, Mr. Robert, your evidence.
You saw whether it could just rely on the case law and the.
So, one of my questions is you will be referring to that later.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the other thing is you've got to realize in the context that this is still the strategic chapter, and then you've got the whole landscape chapter sitting underneath that. So, I think you would still be good to find guidance in those projects and policies.
In the landscape.
That's right. So I viewed it as this is setting up a very high level ONL rural landscape. We need to, in my opinion, avoid renewal, mitigate the effects of development in the rural landscape. That then you flow down into the landscape chapter that will provide more guidance on the values that are particularly important and relevant to that landscape in the process.
Could that including with the policy that you've proposed there in conjunction with the objectives and policies in Chapter 6 lead to ambiguities? Potentially.
Be an inherent tension with the objectives on landscape in Chapter 3 and Chapter 6, potentially. Yeah, that's a risk, depending on how far the objectives and or policies in Chapter 3 go in relation to Chapter 6.
Yeah. Do you think we should try and resolve those tensions as part of our job?
Yep, absolutely. I mean, I think I thought this just, the strategic was just simply a very high level distinguishing the two. And then would leave it to the landscape chapter to really explain in detail how you were going to deal with those issues, i.e. what were the qualities of the, particularly the rural landscape, because I think that's where the greatest pressure around development is, given the history of the district and what's gone before. And fundamentally, that's where I think the biggest issue is with where we've got to currently. This is where I think we need to get to as far as really addressing what the pressures are versus what we think they are.
It's been suggested to us by some other people that potentially removing the policies from Chapter 3 and just having objectives there. What's your view on
that? Yeah, I didn't want to suggest that if it had already been shot down, but yes.
Even if it hadn't been shot down,
my question is why have those objectives there when you're going to go into more detail in landscape chapter, which is the obvious place to deal with that. I understand that this is strategic, and clearly landscape is a strategic matter, so maybe that's why it was there in the first place, but ultimately that's why I suggested quite a high level policy, because I felt that we were just trying to set a very broad scene to then deal with it later on, with the intention that I was hoping the policy I suggested wouldn't create tension, because it was simply directing you down the order towards the landscape chapter.
Oh, that's fine. My question was more, what about if there weren't any policies in chapter?
Yeah,
sorry, there were only objectives, and they were, and then all the detail was in 6. What's your view on that?
Well, it would depend how the objectives, what the wording of those was in relation to the objectives in part 6, I guess. Or are you suggesting you would have no objectives in part 6, you just have policies?
I would question
why you would then have an objective sitting in part 3. If all of the detail that really matters to how you're going to determine dealing with that issue is in Chapter 6.
Is that only in relation to landscape, or because those strategic directions, as I understand it, are set at a higher level to give a general direction for the whole district across a whole range of numbers?
Yes.
Matters rather. Is it just in regard to Chapter 6, or is should there not be like a strategic direction at all?
I haven't thought about that idea, to be fair. I can see the benefit in trying to see the big picture for Queenstown, particularly around growth.
Just on growth or other matters?
Well, I mean, landscape is a strategic issue, and so I can see why there was a desire to have it in the strategic chapter. I think the issue is what the tension that you then create between effectively having those matters then addressed in the urban development chapter and the landscape chapter, for example, and how you manage any inconsistencies or challenges that may happen with the wording in Chapter 3 versus the other two.
Couldn't though somebody, planners, work all that out so that they minimise?
That should be an absolute. If you're going to keep the tiered system in there, you absolutely have to work forward and back to make sure that those, for example, on the landscape, those provisions, the objective policies do work towards or sit well with what you've got in the strategic chapter.
Carry on. paragraph C, 4 on your evidence. I just wanted to clarify if we've received, and I'm not aware of, or this, the last part of the sentence, pastoral appearance are not independent economically viable pastoral operations. Is what you're relying on in terms of that, or what should we be relying on?
Well, I've got the example below, and it's the economics is addressed in the submission.
What paragraph did you refer to?
34 and 35.
The other part of that experience is with dealing with clients who have land, say outside of Morgan Hill, for example, that appear partial. There's a cheap running over them, but when you find out, you know, that's a leased arrangement with other, say one that's quite typical in the basin, that one person will lease a bunch of different bits of land to try and get to a point where they have enough land to run something economically. Because of the challenges and around one of the land you need down here to be able to farm it well, given the environmental type challenges. And also,
chicken and egg situation here. The farming's not economically viable because the land is so valuable for rural lifestyle purposes.
Well, there's some basic fun. Like, I come from a farm background, so we have a sort of farm, but living in the farm. But there's some basic parameters to making a farm viable, irrespective. And I think that will influence whether or not the farming is viable, irrespective of the land value as such. So the markets, for example, that don't typically get the land, how much it can produce, whether it be cheap or meager, is obviously a different situation. But in the basin, for example, we're talking about pastoral cropping type farming, and the markets will big influence on what that's viable or is because of what the value of the land is.
Is it a scale issue?
Yep.
Does further subdivision exacerbate that problem?
Potentially. If that is the state at the moment. And that's what I think is, in my opinion, the issue that we have here is that isn't.
Is it past subdivision that has caused the problem?
Yes.
Individual landowners must do their own equations of their regardless of the economics of farming, as you were describing before, in terms of opportunity cost, if they can make X from farming versus two times X by kind of rather than selling it. That's probably a reasonably easy choice to make.
Yeah, in certain instances, if it's currently farmed in that way, and the alternative is the way that the farming for subdivision.
Yeah, but it is a value land. It comes down to, you have that same block of land down in some other area down Hackett somewhere where the value is low and not demand for it, therefore the whole drive will be different. They're far something become viable.
Well, I mean, I'm not a farm economic expert, but the land to farm up here in the basin too is very challenging to farm. The growing seasons are very short. Its productivity is very low compared to Southland, for example. So to just simply presume that the only driver is whether or not you're going to make more money out of subdivision versus carrying on farming, I think is a little bit oversimplified.
How long has it been farmed for?
What's that?
How long has it been farmed for?
Well, yeah, obviously quite a long
time. So somebody comes to a point, it's been farmed viably for a lot of years now. I know, sorry, we can get into the arguing about farming.
Yeah, I think in certain circumstances, yes, but when you pass subdivision, etc., and changes have influenced the viability of that farming.
Yeah.
Sorry, the only other thing I'd like to say is, you know, the market in that has changed significantly in terms of the viability of farming over the years. You know, there's no longer government subsidies on wool and exports and all sorts of things. So, I mean, to suggest that that's static, I think, is quite.
Turning to paragraph 56, where you've made the recommended amendments. I'm not going to go back and forward between that one and the new version, whatever, but just in terms of, could you just expand on why you've taken out the consideration of the methods of assessment in those two policies? Okay.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure if it adds much more to do that. I mean, I would have thought you have to consider the system matters if they're there. So isn't it, how is it adding, I think, to the assessment?
Isn't it rather than what it adds to the assessment, shouldn't the policy be determined first? An assessment criteria later.
Yes.
Thank you. That's me, sir.
Yes, I understood that.
Surprise as I was.
Ms. Rock's still here.
Just looking at paragraph 31. Wondering what the policy that you've provided there, the reading you've provided, are you suggesting there's an unlimited capacity for residential development in the rural zone?
No, I'm not.
But is that when you agree with this planet?
At some point, yes.
Do you think perhaps the plan should identify or give some indication of when that will not like be
when? When?
Or how? Or what circumstances will tell us that the limit is being reached?
Well, I mean, I think the starting point is it going to be in this district plan's lifetime or not? And then the challenges around how you define that. I think I felt having that reference opens that up to a lot of debate. say that there is a point where that enough's enough. And if you can do that, you need to be pretty clear on what that point is. And I think when you look at the landscape assessments, particularly facing Dr. Reed's report, did identify areas that were more vulnerable and other areas that had more ability to absorb change. And so I think if you were to be more, took a finer view of the landscape, then that may help to help direct that judgment.
Can you basically agree with Ms. Reed's assessment?
Well, I agree that there are areas that are more vulnerable than others, and that there are areas with the ability to still absorb more change.
And you're referring to Dr. Reed's report, specifically on the Waikato Basin.
The areas of classification that she identifies, she breaks it all up into different geographic areas, basically, and then talks about the characteristics of each and sort of identifies some as being quite vulnerable to further degradation. And I think she even mentioned some to need more protection or suggest greater protection, something like that. And then others she identifies have more ability to absorb change.
Do you think there'd be some value in including some policy direction based on what the report in the plan?
Yes. I think the concept is sound in trying to take it finer. If you're going to be so directive in managing things, then you need to be more specific with what you're doing.
When it says residential activity in that policy as it is now, what do you understand that to provide for residential activity in rural areas? What do you understand that to mean?
Mean in a very broad sense, rural, say a rural living house or anything like that. Yeah.
Not necessarily urban.
Urban. No, yeah, that's, do you think it means urban?
No, I didn't see it that way.
In paragraph 39, you refer to scenic flights there. Is it the flight you're referring to, or the taking off and landing?
The taking off and landing.
Across the page, very top of the page, you refer to objective 3.2.5.5, and you refer to other activities that are fundamental to the character of our landscape. And I'm just wondering if you could give us some examples.
So the skyline is one example I was thinking of when I thought of that. Skyline.
Skyline.
I think bungee jumping in those activities in the relationship between the rural and the space and providing for those communities.
So they rely on rural resources, so that's not the sort of thing that can be happening in the centre of town.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's certain activities that could go nowhere else that, in my opinion, are appropriate use of that rural resource that isn't necessary agricultural land use.
Is plus rural living in that category something that relies on a rural resource?
Yes.
In paragraph 60, we talked about rural living there. Do you see that there should be a distinction between the rural living, the rural residential, the rural lifestyle, and the rural zone in terms of development and subdivision outcomes?
As the provisions are currently drafted there, yes, there is. The rural living, rural res is a very fragments the landscape up into one hectare lots or 4,000 square metre lots, whereas the whole principle of the rural general discretionary regime is to cluster or direct the development into the parts of the landscape that can absorb that change while protecting other areas, and that's not a really consideration under that rural lifestyle rules framework as it's currently provided.
Do you maybe put it this way, in your experience, can the way the rural zone is drafted lead to a situation where development is more intense than in the rural lifestyle zone?
Yes. If you're simply taking you just average the total land area by the amount of lots and saying, oh, is that the similar density or more than you'd get under a rural lifestyle arrangement? Is that what you're saying? Yes.
And is that
Yes, I think so. I think the outcome that you're getting in terms of landscape is better under the rural general than it is under the rural lifestyle.
In paragraph 86, you've added in that objection, objective and commercial recreation after tourism is, I would have thought commercial recreation is a subset of tourism.
Tourism. take it as a subset, but I felt it was helpful to strengthen that by making it clear, given the references in the plan to which we're referring.
Commercial recreation is that with and picking up on whether it's true. So something like the polo facility, do you consider that commercial recreation or something else? Some of these things might be like developed for the library as well.
Yeah.
Is that what you're getting?
Well, that's right. I don't think all commercial recreation is tourism all the time. Polo. Depending on how it's proposed, yeah, it can be commercial recreation.
Yes,
thank you. Your point 2526 on page 6, you say that your amendment, that you don't like ritual because of the uncertainty of meaning and that yours provides greater clarity and certainty. I'm just wondering how recognise the landscape character and vision of all together is your landscape classification gives any certainty in terms of outcome.
It goes back to the way I saw the structure working as this will set the direction that it's important to distinguish that landscape. And then it sets at a high level that direction that then flows into the landscape chapter.
I accept that, except what we're doing is saying recognise it, we're not saying to then doing it in the market.
Well, that's why I felt would flow down in the lower order, in the check landscape.
I don't think that, in fact, the strategic direction chapter would be worth it at that higher objective level to say, and we actually want to do something with that, as opposed to just recognise it.
Well, when I viewed it, I thought that most of the direction was being provided in Chapter 6, and so I felt there needed to draw the line somewhere to distinguish Chapter 3 from Chapter 6, which I guess is that challenge that we talked about a little bit earlier.
Okay, then if we go to the next one.
I have a follow-on question from that. And I'm just wondering, from what you're saying, it comes back to our earlier discussion about Chapter 3 and whether it doesn't have objectives. Am I understanding from what you're saying that you consider that policies in Chapter 3 should give some direction within the plan as to how the lower order chapters deal with things?
So you've got the policies in Chapter 3 directing how you may use chapters alone.
Yes. Is that what you would...
Yep.
You may not have reached that in your mind, but it seems to be what...
Well, there has to be some link back up, because otherwise I don't... Well, the way I've interpreted it is that you don't read the landscape chapter to one side as a strategic, it's an umbrella, so that they do all work together, either up or down. So that's how I viewed those Chapter 3 objectives and policies. They had to be synced in with what was happening below. And then that becomes the challenge of when do you leave it in Chapter 3 and deal with it in Chapter 6, or vice versa.
So then can we go to your paragraph 29, which seems to go against what we've just said, because you make it quite specific. You say, enable subdivision use of development to occur in those areas where adverse effects on landscape and visual amenity can be avoided and mitigated. And then, again, further down on 31, you take out the recognition of finite assets, but put in provide residential activity in rural areas while recognising influence. So it seems to be much more specific.
That's right. Well, I think fundamentally I was just working with what was there. I didn't try and really start afresh.
But don't they seem to contradict what you said in 26 versus what you said in 29 and 31 in terms of question of what strategic direction establishment should hold as opposed to management in terms of specificity?
I think that's probably true. I don't think when I looked at this I hadn't really turned my mind to how we really should split the chapters. I was just working with the wording that was there and my view of that and how it needed to change. I admit I probably didn't take a step back and re-evaluate the whole structure between chapters 3 and 6 and whether or not there was a better way of doing it or a better way of splitting the distinction in chapters 3 and 6.
And then going back to 29, you've taken out the potential to absorb change and made it, it seems quite a more enabling.
Well, again, I do think that is at the broad level because it's setting up for the lower chapter to deal with that.
What is your definition then of potential to absorb change?
Well, it's not a definition. It's more of a value of the assessment that's made around whether or not the landscape is potential to absorb change. You don't define it as such as a term and definition.
No, but the verbs you use then give some indication of what you're expected to be able to do, and that potential to absorb change, you're suggesting that subdivision should be enabled and could be mitigated.
Yes.
So if it can be mitigated, then how absorbable is the change? It sounds like it's quite a wide spectrum of absorptiveness of that word.
Yeah, and it's, I think all the chapter 6 provisions would guide that.
Given your earlier conversation, Mr. Williams, aren't these, as they're currently framed in your evidence here, more like policies than actual objectives? So in 26, recognise the landscape character. What's the environmental outcome sought there? Is it the recognition of something rather than...
No, I feel that that's still setting a direction.
Sorry, what's the environmental outcome that's sought there?
The outcome is that they are identified. Same.
So that identification is an action, it's a policy, you know. Where do we want to... Is the outcome that we're seeking... The recognition. So what?
Mm-hmm.
As a test.
Well, I would have thought that's where the policy would help you direct to that. But also, again, I don't think you can just simply read that in isolation of the chapter 6. Because what I felt I was doing was trying to identify that way of dealing with landscape and identifying a classification system, and then the part 6 matters would then deal with how you would provide for the issues that they face.
Going back to 3254, you say that your suggestion would be to direct and inform relevant policies. How does it provide residential activity in rural areas while recognising the importance of district landscapes direct and inform?
Well, Well, I think it's setting up that residential development is can form part of that landscape fundamentally. And identifying that as the balance between that and the importance of the landscape, that is the assessment that needs to be made. And that's coming back to that over domestication, which I think is really what the finite resource slash cumulative effect issue is really about. It's an over domestication of the landscape.
Okay, thank you. In terms of, we'll just pause for that, the over domestication is the question of where the finite slash cumulative effects comes in. Can that be defined?
Over-domestication,
yeah,
as a definition of the plan?
Well, as something that you aim to avoid. So, you were talking about the issue of finite. Is it in this plan, or is it beyond the lifetime of this plan, and how do you identify it?
It will depend on the particular landscape. So, say, for example, going back to the Dr. Reed's report, the area where she had identified little of the lived and absorbed change, it may be that one or two more or no more in that particular area will over domesticate it, or that is the threshold. But to blanketly apply that across, I think, is problematic.
So you feel, am I right in understanding you'd be saying that you believe Ms. Reed's report, Dr. Reed's report, does to an extent give us that finer grain definition of what would be over domestication?
I think it's helpful as a starting point. Because I think the plan is, the current plan, I think, is good in that it recognises that the landscape, particularly North to place in rural living, is a component, component of that, and isn't necessarily a bad thing. It brings with it the planting and other things that make that landscape what it is, the character of it. And therefore, from that, you then need to determine its ability to absorb further change. And obviously, Ms. Reed has gone back through all that and looked at it again since to see what's happened. But the monitoring report the council did as well looked at that and how well it was working and what was changing and looking at that domestication matter. And I think that's the primary concern. Then, yes, you'd be better served to identify the finer grain where these areas are and then apply provisions differently to that.
Point 56, and over the page. So looking at your policy rewrites, the 6313 and 6314, you've actually got exactly the same wording for rural and for ONO zonings, i.e. Adverse effects on landscape character and visual amenity values are avoided, remedied, assuming we or mitigated. Are you saying that ONLs, I guess, and rural landscape should be treated in the same way? And how would we then be meeting our requirements under 6B?
No, I'm not saying that.
You're using exactly the same word. So,
yeah.
Where is that given guidance?
Well, the assessment matters will help guide that.
Should we not provide some level of guidance at the policy level?
Yep.
So
I don't think that's the... Sorry.
Would you have a suggestion on how to...
Well, I don't think that's the only policy, though. There's a number of policies and objectives that relate to how they're on their score.
So you don't
think
so? Point 67, you have added the word visual to amenity values. Do you think that is the only amenity factor that should be considered in terms of cumulative effects? Because there are obviously a lot of other ones in rural areas.
so that's what we're trying to deal with development. There's its impact on that.
So
are you familiar with the Environment Court decisions? In fact, I think it's the Planning Tribunal all the time. That have said that landscape values go beyond visual, they would include other sensory experiences of the landscape.
I'm not familiar with that particular decision that you're referring to, but
you're
talking about like the spaciousness or the quietness of the environment,
it's
for example.
Yes, and then it could also be the smell of the environment.
Oh, right, yes.
You know,
or the
time,
so nice
the, you know, the time and the spring, things like that. Signage.
Signage. Yep.
That was signage, not signage. Although, actually.
So, I mean, given that, do you think maybe it may not be sensible to narrow the amenity values under consideration to purely visual?
Yes, I can see what you're saying, but I think it's the key one for dealing with human effects in the landscape context here.
But in Dr. Reed's report, he didn't use the term visual amenity.
No.
She used the term visual qualities.
Mm.
It's quite a different thing. Are you trying to align it with her explanation of the landscape, or are you...
Oh, it's more aligning it with what the plan is at the moment, vision and museum. Right.
So going to your previous statement that you felt the granularity of this rural landscape system should be done within the landscape chapter, looking at your point 75. You say, in your opinion, 6341, in your opinion, 6342 too high. And so you have in there, in the ONLONF, avoid and you add, remedy or mitigate adverse effects of subdivision and development that will vary particularly important qualities of landscape and character and community, particularly where there is no or little capacity to absorb change. I would have thought that those last words or whatever it is, would suggest that mitigation is actually protecting, and you are saying that that is where that policy direction should be given, to protection against that. Surely that would be within that policy, and you don't seem to differentiate it at all from what you had in your initial suggestion for that. Because how would you...
Fundamentally, I think the landscape, it comes back to the resource you're dealing with, which is the landscape, which is a very broad area. And so, its ability to absorb change varies depending on what you're receiving within the ONL. And so that's why I think mitigation or remedying those effects is appropriate.
Even where the sentence is strongly qualified by the words, particularly where there is no or little capacity to absorb change, which would suggest that for some reason in that area.
Well, I think that's the general principle applied to the ONLs, is that in general their ability to absorb change is limited.
So should the policy direction be that where there is little or no ability to absorb change, the plan should be aiming to discourage development in that area? Because from earlier questions, you've suggested that it's appropriate to direct it to areas where there is the ability to absorb change. But the converse requires discouraging in other areas.
I agree. This particular ONL. Basically, marks in there, for example, clearly have very little ability to absorb has all changed, but I view these policies as applying across the board, and therefore it is too restrictive.
Well, but if there is no ability to absorb, or very little ability to absorb change, isn't it irrelevant whereabouts within the O&L of the district it is?
Mm.
Because that determination, that there's no ability to absorb change, isn't that the focus?
So you've already analysed whether or not it can absorb change.
Yeah, well, that's what the policy requires you to do, doesn't it?
Yeah. But it's not, I didn't read the policy, it's simply me. It's qualifying it by saying particularly where that's not the only application of that policy, is the way I read it.
But it's also about avoiding or not degrading the important qualities of the landscape character and amenity.
Yeah. That's right.
So don't those two things still bring you to the same place? While it's a large area, and in fact council have told us that something like 45% of the privately owned land in the district is identified as O&L. That the wording in the second half of that policy is really dealing with those matters about this little ability to avoid change and you don't want to degrade the landscape. In those circumstances, should you have a policy that just says, well, you can mitigate it without any indication as to the extent or mitigation or otherwise?
Well, I mean, to just simply avoid it, I don't see why it's necessary if mitigation could get you there.
So if you've got 45% of the privately owned land and O&L,
yes,
there must be in that area, which is it's thousands of square kilometres.
Yeah, yeah.
There must be some areas that are able to absorb change.
Yes.
And where you could do things without degrading the landscape.
Yes.
Isn't the policy aimed to getting you to go to those places and avoiding the rest?
And you're saying that's what the policy does?
Yes. Yeah. Isn't that the point of it? Mm-hmm. To say, go and find places where you can do the thing without degrading the landscape, and you can, there is the ability to absorb change and do it there. It may not be in your ownership, but that's the place to do it.
Okay, so the way I had read it was it had two elements, and the particular was an add-on. But if that's not the case, then just remove the word particular. Because what you're saying is these are the areas where there's no or little...
Well, would it be better to meet our 6B requirement and to hear what you were saying, would it perhaps be better to have two points? One saying avoid subdivision development, but degrading more quantities, particularly where there is no or little capacity to absorb change, and then something more direct.
Enabling
where it can. Where it's I hear what you're saying, but I think your solution is the wrong solution.
Yeah, I think it does need to be, I agree with Commissioner Gilmore, there does need to be the positive aspect. Yeah. So that
I guess people leaving
the team know that they should be looking for those areas where it can go rather than just trying to fit it in.
Because I read that this was the policy and it didn't really recognise that the landscape is broad and there are areas because of the way it linked particularly. But I see if you split it, then that's it.
I've been jumping on the table. Sorry.
So I just wanted to be clear. So I was suggesting that if the intention is this is a directive policy to deal with the areas that have no ability to absorb change, you wouldn't have the words remedy or mitigate adverse effects, it would be deleted, and you would delete particularly.
Well, that's one option, but I think from what I understand you to say, you agree that the plan should be encouraging people to go into the areas where there are.
Yes, that's
just
right.
The ability to absorb change, so they can do it without the way of the landscape, yes. Notwithstanding it's an RNL, and that the plan policy should be framed to get that to happen and to stop it happening in the other places.
That's right. I view them as being more blankly towards no. As opposed to recognising that it will vary depending on the qualities of the landscape.
Well,